Hey, it's John, and you've probably heard me talk about True Diagnostics' True Age Test. My results were a game changer, but have you tried it? Here's why I think you should. Many of the health risks that accompany aging are in your control. The True Age Test didn't just give me a number, it showed me how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging. It was eye-opening. The test will give you tailored tips from Ivy League scientists, like tweaking diet and sleep, to slow aging and cut risks. As a result, I started taking more vitamin C and a mushroom supplement that seems to be helping me with focus and overall health. It was so easy, a quick at-home finger prick, send it off, and in 2 to 3 weeks, I got a detailed report. No doctor, no hassle. If you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code, Harris, to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use HARRIS at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you.
The report goes into great detail about the information that Russia and Putin had on Hillary Clinton, which included possible criminal acts like secret meetings with multiple named U.S. religious organizations in which State Department officials offered, in exchange for supporting Secretary Clinton's campaign for the presidency, significant increases in financing from the State Department. They also had documents that showed the patronage of the State Department to State Department employees who would go and support Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. There were high-level DNC emails that detailed evidence of Hillary's, quote, psycho-emotional problems, uncontrolled fits of anger, aggression, and cheerfulness, and that then Secretary Clinton was allegedly on a daily regimen of heavy tranquilizers. Then CIA Director Brennan and the intelligence community mischaracterized intelligence and relied on dubious substandard sources to create a contrived false narrative that Putin developed a quote-unquote clear preference for Trump.
And there you have it. Tulsi Gabbard today at a press conference. I think this was this afternoon, so it wasn't all that long ago, talking about these declassified documents that are making their way to the surface. They revealed that the Steele dossier, which alleged ties between Donald Trump's 2016 campaign and Russian interference, if you remember, that this was included in the main body of the 2017 intelligence community assessment called the ICA on Russian election interference. And this contradicts claims made by the top Obama administration officials like John Brennan and James Clapper, who said that it didn't, and they actually pushed ICA documents to Congress and others that had left out this particular information. So now we're finally getting it. Now we're finally seeing what's actually happening. This is why you saw Trump earlier this week saying outright that Obama is responsible for treason, that what he did was technically treasonous. Now, if these officials aren't punished, if there's nothing to come back on them, if there's no justice, that means that we're in deep trouble. And I don't expect that to happen, but I'm hopeful that something will happen. Obviously, no one truly gets away with anything, because at the end of your life, when you die, you will eventually stand before God, and he is able to destroy the body and the soul in hell, not just the body, as Jesus said. So no one gets away with anything. But if we're going to have a life to pass down to our descendants, to our children especially, we want to make sure that our institutions in this country are trusted again. And they're not right now. The CIA is not trusted. Neither really are any of the intelligence agencies. Obviously, the IRS hasn't been trusted for a long time, but it's now like everything's the IRS. Everything in government is viewed with suspicion, and that's not a good place to be at all for any country. That means it's an opportune moment. It's the moment is ripe for someone to come in with very innovative ideas that sound good on paper that may not actually be good, revolutionary schemes, and to gain a mass following based on that, using low information voters and people who aren't really thinking straight about these things, but are whipped up into an emotional frenzy, and they can take over the government quite easily because there is nothing to keep the present system in place. There's no reason to get behind it and support it. Why would you, right? It's so corrupt, and we're finding out more and more about its corruption. And so the Trump administration has an opportunity here, a window, a small window to do something about that, but the trust has to be restored, and it has to be restored soon. And that's where we're at. And the reason I played you that particular clip, though, is pretty obvious for listeners of this podcast, I would think. You heard in that particular clip Tulsi Gabbard saying that actually, if you want to be honest about what was really happening, Hillary Clinton, the Clinton campaign, was actually involved with paying religious organizations for support and offering them perks. Now, what does that look like exactly? Well, she said it, but it's also in this particular document, which I will show you. This is the document that was just released, Oversight Investigation and Referral, September 18th, 2020, the Intelligence Community Assessment. This is the ICA. And the title is Russia's Influence Campaign Targeting the 2016 U.S. Presidential Election. Now, if you type in the phrase religious organizations, you'll find on, I don't know what page this is, but about almost halfway through the document, that there is this section. It says the Russian Federal Security Service in August had details of secret meetings. So the Russians had knowledge of something that was going on in our politics. And what did they have knowledge of? There were multiple named U.S. religious organizations in which the U.S. State Department representatives offered in exchange for supporting Secretary Clinton significant increases in financing from department funds and the patronage of state in dealing with post-Soviet countries. Now, if you notice, one of those post-Soviet countries would probably be Ukraine. And it makes you wonder to what extent you have the State Department of the United States acting as an arm of the Democratic National Committee and telling religious organizations they need to support Hillary Clinton and they will have some kind of access, some kind of special patronage in the former Soviet places. Ukraine has to be at the top of the list in everyone's mind on this. And of course, there's a lot of Christian organizations over there in Ukraine. There's a lot of charities, quote unquote, but there's also a lot of corruption. Ukraine is known for this. And so the question I have is, what does this look like? There's no details in the report, but obviously somewhere this exists. Somewhere there, someone knows what was actually taking place. And maybe this explains some of the shenanigans we saw. Now, I'm not saying it explains all of it. I still am a firm believer, and I don't think this will change, that whether you have support coming from moneyed interests or the government or big business, you are going to have ideologues who spread their ideology. But the way that ideologues get other people to see the utopian dream they're selling and support them, even though those people aren't ideologues, those people are opportunists generally, the way that ideologues get opportunists to support their schemes is oftentimes through financial incentives. And I think that's what you have here. You have leftists essentially using the apparatus of the state to get religious organizations who should not be and should not have any business taking bribes from anyone to support them. And, you know, I don't know what those organizations were. I don't know. I mean, some of you might be thinking, well, that's got to be the Gospel Coalition or something. That's got to be World Vision. That's got to be, I don't know, if you're in the evangelical world, did the Southern Baptists take any money? Was Crew taking money? I know I saw a lot of woke stuff coming from them. I know even, you know, the Gospel Coalition published an article supportive of Hillary Clinton. Were they actively taking money? Was Russell Moore on the payroll somewhere? Was he? And I don't have answers to those things. And the document doesn't tell you exactly, but something was obviously going on. And I'm sure this went way beyond Protestant denominations. This sounds like it was broader. It was religious. We don't even know if it was limited to just Christianity, although I'm sure in the United States, it was probably heavily Christian. So how's that to get your afternoon revved up here as you think about the corruption in our government? That is certainly corruption. And I want to bring to your attention a letter. This is from July 15th by the Evangelical Immigration Table. And it is to Congress. And here's what it looks like. It says, dear members of Congress, we write to you to urge you to consider the newly reintroduced Dignity Act sponsored by Representative Maria Salazar. I talked about this on the last podcast, which would establish a restitution-based legalization process for immigrants present in the United States, unlawfully who are willing to pay a significant fine as a penalty for their violation of the immigration law, to submit to and pass a criminal background check, and to meet other appropriate requirements. Now, I already said, look, this is $1,000 a year for 7 years. Come on, really? I mean, what kind of benefits are you getting that exceed that number likely? Now, okay, you have to pay a fine. You're here, I think it's 7 years. And then what happens after that? Because this particular representative, Maria Salazar, has also said, well, for now, we just we let them in the country, essentially, and we let them stay here. But it's to a future government, it's future political politicians to make the decision as to what to do with them permanently and to extend citizenship to them, which is what we know was behind this from the beginning. We know what a scheme like this is. If you're not after solving this right now, you're not after solving it. You're playing games, you're playing politics, but I think more than that, you're actually trying to get a amnesty situation, because the politics, especially in the Republican Party, which Maria Salazar is a member of, the politics favor actually deporting people right now. But anyway, it goes on. It says that equally as important, the proposal does not provide amnesty, right? It always says, they always say, we don't provide, it's not about amnesty. It's always like, it's a step towards amnesty or two steps towards amnesty. It's never amnesty, though. Instead, it would actually exclude these individuals from receiving federal benefits and or entitlement program resources for which they have not paid in. Moreover, the Dignity Act would ensure that immigrants who have committed violent crimes are deported, keeping our community safe. So, I mean, what does that mean, though? Paid in? Like, can you take advantage of welfare benefits simply because, well, you're paying in at a certain level, even though most of your work is off the books? Like, what's this practically going to look like? That's what the American people want to know. And I think most of the American people, at least on the Republican side, are firmly against this from the outset. While the vast majority of evangelical Christians believe that violent criminals should be prioritized for deportation, Lifeway research finds only 17% of evangelicals say the same about those who would be willing to pay a fine as restitution for breaking U.S. immigration. So it goes on. Let me just get to some details that are actually relevant here. They cite statistics we've talked about before from this Lifeway research, because this is supposed to make the case that evangelical Christians are actually behind this. The base of the Republican Party really does want this, which I've talked about before. I don't think that this is probably accurate. I think this is an attempt to prove that evangelical Christians are in favor of these things by organizations that are that evangelical Christians are paying for, essentially. So they're representing evangelical Christians. They are getting money from the government and often for resettlement programs, that kind of thing. In fact, look at the people who are mentioned here. The Asian American Christian Collaborative, they're left wing. The Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, I would say they're kind of left wing. The Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission for the SBC, they're left wing. The National Association of Evangelicals, they're left wing. The National Latino Evangelical Coalition, they're left wing. And World Relief, they're very left wing. So those are the organizations, but they all interface with evangelicals and claim to represent them. And so they need to prove somehow that they have this groundswell of support, but it makes no sense. It makes no sense given the fact that why would it be that whatever it was, 81% of evangelicals voted for Donald Trump, and they knowing that his policies on the front end were to take care of this problem. And then, oh no, almost a comparable number actually don't want those policies. That doesn't make any sense. So I'm very skeptical about it, but as Christians committed to the rule of law rooted in the biblical conviction that God has ordained the government to restrain evil and ensure order, we believe the Dignity Act offers necessary reforms, et cetera. Now, I made the case this should just be called the Anti-Dignity Act, or I don't know, the something. Find a different name. Find a different name that calls it what it is. This is, if you had dignity, you would be not wanting to break the law, not wanting to encourage that, wanting people to make things right. That would be the restoration of dignity. So I would say the Trump administration is more in favor of dignity. This kind of a law is actually against dignity, if you really want to make this about dignity. But of course, they play these word games to garner emotional support and that kind of thing. So with that being said, to open the program here, maybe I'll go to this next. I wasn't going to do this until towards the end, but why not? I just mention it to you in passing here. CRU, the organization that used to be called Campus Crusade, just had their yearly, I think it's yearly, annual conference. And they had Dr. Crawford Loritz there and Daryl Smith speaking there. And those who have followed this podcast for any length of time know those two names have been very associated with trafficking and social justice ideas into evangelical organizations, mostly Crew, and they're still speaking. And I saw some quotes on a live tweet that someone was putting out there, and they certainly seem more veiled, but they also seem social justice, couched social justice language, like Christians can't support powerful institutions. They have to choose between that and Jesus and stuff like that. And if you are used to reading these guys, you know what that means in their mind. But I don't have access to the videos, which Crew is probably very thankful for. And I haven't asked anyone for access, so I haven't put a great deal of thought into this. What I have received, though, and I can tell you this from someone who is involved in Crew, actually from more than one person involved in Crew, is that things are much tamer this year. And so while there was apparently in Daryl Smith's speech in particular, some social justice sounding language, overall, they're not going that direction. And I explained this to one of the Crew missionaries who I think maybe they already agreed with me and didn't need the explanation. I'm not sure, but we were having a conversation. And I said, look, you know, my experience with Crew missionaries is there's a lot of Stockholm syndrome. There's it functions kind of like a cult in a way. You're not allowed to question authority. It's very authoritarian. And whatever the authorities who are in charge of the organization say must be followed. It's kind of like the military in that sense. You can't question orders. And questioning orders, that's the basis upon which you'll be fired. I don't think it's purely ideology. I think there's ideology at play in all of this. There's a pressure coming from the left. There's also a pressure coming from the right for Crew, but I think Crew has responded to the pressure from the left probably more so, even though, yes, they got rid of their Lenses Institute. They're trying to walk a line is what they're doing. And they're trying to make sure everyone's happy. And of course, no one's happy, but they're keeping people like Daryl Smith around. And they want to project this image that they are compassionate and they care about some of these social justice issues, even if they're not going to be quite as woke with their rhetoric as they used to be at the national stage. So I think they want to have their cake and eat it. I think that this will continue in Crew. And I think the same thing is true for other organizations. So you have, for example, sorry, I'm trying to silence. I don't know if anyone heard that. I'm trying to silence my Signal app because I'm hearing it in my ear. Another organization is Moody Bible Institute. And I've noticed that Charlie Dates is speaking or has spoken there recently. And again, another person who is, I would say, woke. I don't really have any qualms about that. We've talked about it many times on the podcast before. And Moody obviously has a conservative evangelical history, but they're not responding to the pressure that was exerted in the years following 2020 to root out social justice and DEI programs and policies and personnel in these organizations has on some level failed. It has been successful in other places, but I think the main takeaway has been that these organizations will not admit failure. They will go quiet, and the social justice stuff typically will be in other arenas. For example, I know at Wheaton College, there have been events where they're not recorded. There's no access to the recording. And there's some hardcore woke stuff still happening. And it's frustrating because it's like this stuff was exposed before. They wanted everyone to know in 2020, look at us, look what we're doing. I think that's obviously changed. They want to get away from that kind of reputation, but I don't think the ideology has left the building. I think that the people who traffic this stuff in are still there. There's been no repentance. There's been no admission of wrongdoing. This is it's the same for a lot of places. Now, the question is whether places like, I don't know, Grove City College that are more politically conservative, and Liberty University, right, which didn't have as bad of a problem, but certainly had one university that big is going to have it, whether or not they climb out of this because of the general vibe on the right. That's where I see more of a lasting change. But if they don't have that, if it's not a political thing, if it's stayed just sort of a theological evangelical institution, I don't have a lot of confidence that when the political winds shift, they won't just go back to doing what they were doing before. Kind of sad, but That's my assessment. And I'm just grateful it's not, for whatever reason, even if it's a bad motive, I'm grateful it's not as bad as it was in some of these places. So there's your little snippet update on both Moody and crew. Now, I want to mention this. This is sort of my in the middle of the podcast. This isn't a story, but I do want to say the men's retreat is coming up. And if you have not signed up as a man, you're going to want to come. Whether you like music or not, this is for you. We're going to have a great time in the Adirondack Mountains. We go hiking and fishing, and there's a lot of outdoor stuff. It's great food. It's great fellowship. We only charge costs, so it's pretty inexpensive for what you're getting. And we have a great lineup. You're going to hear things about, oh, wow, I didn't even change that. Someone changed AD's profile on this. So he was cartoon AD, and now he's not. So that's kind of cool. Anyway, there's going to be things you hear at this conference I'm pretty certain you have not heard before about the topic of music. And it's not just about music, but music's a big part of this. And we're going to have campfire time where we have different styles of traditional hymns, and we're going to have folk music in the church. We'll have some history lessons on that. But you're also going to hear some audible representations of the differences between styles and why certain styles are advantageous over others and that kind of thing. So can't recommend it more highly. You got to come out, musicandmasculinity.com to sign up. We always have a great time at the men's retreat, and there's my plug for that. Okay, let's move on to some encouraging news. I want to let you know about this. New York, the state that I'm sitting in right now, has paid $225,000 to end the legal battle with Christian photographer over same-sex weddings. Now, I'm actually kind of encouraged by this, that this ended up with, it was probably going to go into federal litigation, but New York State decided they were not going to press the matter anymore. The U.S. District Court for the Western District of New York and New York's Democratic Attorney General and Commissioner of the New York State Division of Human Rights have been ordered not to enforce several provisions of New York's anti-discrimination laws against Emily Carpenter Photography. Now, if you listen to this podcast, I know I've said that like four times. Hey, you got to listen to the podcast. But if you listen to the podcast, you'll know this is one of the things I was concerned about before the election. New York State passed a provision that actually changed their constitution, and it put in a non-discrimination clause to the effect that you can't say anything against someone's immigration status, let alone their LGBTQ plus whatever identity. So pretty radical, extreme stuff, and hard to eradicate because it's part of the constitution now. And it's good that you at least have some pressure there coming from, this is what I said. I said the federal government's going to pressure this. And I think that's what's happening. And that's a good thing to see. Alliance Defending Freedom was involved. You can read the more about it if you're curious, but I think this is a win, and hopefully this stays. I mean, it does matter who's in the White House, even for these state level policies. We're going to go to, I have a bunch of little things, and then we're going to get to some broader things. I'm working towards the Zoomer stuff that I want to talk about. So this was interesting. My good friend, Sean McGowan, Pastor Sean McGowan, Presbyterian friend. I do have some Presbyterian friends, that is. He talked about how PCA churches, if you walk in, there's going to be a variety of different worship practices, and that this is unfortunate. And, you know, I thought when I first saw that, I was like, I don't know like how heavy regulative principle Sean McGowan is, but is he saying you got to sing psalms? Is he saying you got to, I don't think he's there. I think he's more like traditional hymns are best. Anyway, now I know what he meant more. Okay. David Cassidy, David Cassidy is serving at Spanish River Church. Okay, so I think he's the president there. I've seen this guy before. Oh, yeah, I know I've seen this guy. Okay. David Cassidy was part of the whole like anti-Zach Garris thing last year and just saying some ignorant things. Okay, so anyway, David Cassidy, herein lies the problem of constant conflict. I've no doubt that the worship of the church that Irish Presby serves, and that's Sean McGowan, is faithful. But the desire to impose a single form can only lead to endless debate and division. Let's avoid this. Now, here's just pictures of the worship at Spanish River Church in the PCA. So it's not just super, it's not that it's contemporary, okay? Contemporary just means like present, up to date, that kind of thing. I don't know if anyone has a problem with contemporary. Innovation maybe, but not contemporary. Sloppiness maybe, but not contemporary. But obviously, contemporary is the word that is typically used to under, it's the banner all these other things fall under. And so here it is, right? It's not the contemporary element that's bad. It's just that it's so casual. And you have to wonder, this is what I saw this meme the other day. I know I don't talk about memes much. We shouldn't craft our views based on memes, but I did see this meme that made a great point. And it said, when the world worships their idol, and it's all these sports broadcasters on ESPN, and they're in these amazing suits, pinstripes, and just, they went to the dry cleaners. I mean, it looks good. And then underneath it, you saw the church when they worship their God, and it's images like this. And I understand it's not a, there's traditions and things, there's specific kind of traditions that have developed in these different institutions. But I do think that it's to our peril when we decide that in the worship of God, we are going to just be really casual. I understand, come as you are, let us reason together. The Lord accepts and receives those with a penitent heart who are humble before him. I'm going to be preaching on that this Sunday, actually. And I get that. And if that's what you're used to, but I'm not even necessarily for a dress code, but maybe this church needs it. Maybe this church needs, because it wasn't passed down. And it's like, John, how can you say that based on someone's dress? I'm just telling you, when it's this casual, something is wrong. So you're worshiping the God of the universe, right? And it is more something that it's caught more than taught. It's something you see. I'm not saying these people don't have some fervor for God or worship in their heart, but there's something off as well. And you see in this, these aren't very agreed. Well, there's a woman, I guess. I don't think that's preaching. I'm assuming here. She's probably just reading the Bible. But in a PCA church, conservative PCA church, probably not. And okay, I know people are going to hate me for this, but guys, look, the hoodie with the sports coat. I'm just judgmental, John, right now. I'm not saying that you're not necessarily a person with good intentions and your heart's in the right place and all that, but it's like letting a 13-year-old dress themselves and go on stage. 13-year-olds aren't mature and they don't have a good idea about what's appropriate, what's fitting for the occasion. And this is a serious occasion. I think this is the preacher. This is, you know, something very casual intended for sports, for chilling around, and then mixed with something semi-formal and mixed with jeans. And it's a confusion, guys. It's a confusion. And I saw some of the videos too, and they're worse. But I wanted to weigh in on it, I suppose, somewhat as a teaser for the Music and Masculinity Conference, because we're going to be talking about this. My task is to talk about the importance of tradition. I am convinced, actually, that there is an important element that we have ignored, we meaning many evangelicals who have tried to reinvent the church every 10 years. So not me personally, but many have ignored. And I went through this maybe 20 years ago when I was first playing music. Well, 20, yeah, I guess it was almost 20. Man, I'm getting old. Okay, so almost 20 years ago, when I was playing music for the first time in a church setting and the worship wars were happening, I remember this. I remember there was a guy who came to my church and he did a youth thing where he put all these garbage cans with graffiti on them and he got a smoke machine. And then there was like this punk band at the time. I mean, it's also cringy now looking back because none of this stuff is in style now, right? At the time, it was like, this is so cool. And now you're like, it's like, grandpa, what were you doing back then? But at the time, right, this was supposed to be the thing that would attract the youth. But it didn't attract the youth. What it did was it just sort of pressured the youth who had grown up without that kind of thing, without that culture, to then participate. And then people were just kind of confused standing around. And then I remember the praise team leader, it wasn't a praise team leader, it was just the guy who was leading it, said, all right, everyone jump, right? And I remember this. And I remember the fallout from that. And I remember the parents who didn't like it. And I remember all the arguments. And at the time, you know, the little legalist self that I was, I was just like, well, where in the Bible does it say you can't do this? I don't understand. What's the problem? Because you have to throw all tradition out, right? Tradition doesn't matter at all. Yeah, I need a Bible verse specifically that says this beat or this rhythm or this style or this clothing or this atmosphere is wrong. And I am so 180 degrees against that now and see how foolish and immature I was in my understanding. You know, it was back when I knew it all, and I don't know it all anymore, which is a better place to be, because actually I know more now. Yeah, I think I got that right. So I'm going to be talking about that at the men's retreat, and that's a little teaser for you of what you can expect. This is inappropriate, and I'm going to explain to you in further detail why, and why it's okay to take tradition into account and to take prudential and wisdom-related concerns into account. Because it does communicate something. What you wear does communicate something. How you talk, why in the military do you march in a stiff kind of order? What's that about? Your posture even communicates something. It's complicated. That's what I'm saying. And there are fitting occasions for many different things. Okay. I got to move on here. Actually, wow. I got to move fast, cause I'm leading a Bible study tonight, and, I got to leave in like half an hour or less. So, let's keep going here. Rachel Denhollander, this is a tweet she put out there. And I'm going to just summarize it. She's going after Trump, but she shouldn't have been going after Trump. It was a Christian attorney who had brought this case against the Washington state from enforcing a law that would have required priests to report evidence of child abuse learned during confession. And she did a series of tweets against this and how bad it is, because she's the person who wanted attorney-client privilege waived for the SBC executive committee. She wants what they call priest-penitent privilege waived, but this extends to organizations beyond just the Roman Catholic Church. This is something Protestants also have. It's not the same, but Protestants have a privilege when it comes to counseling situations. And I talked about that with John MacArthur, actually, last week, that they actually had a landmark case that their church won in the 1970s. I think by the time it went to the Supreme Court, it was the early 80s, but where they won essentially, or clarified the right to have someone count under their counseling care that they did not refer out to quote unquote experts in the psychiatric or psychological fields. And they are exempt from the kind of legal the liabilities that those kinds of fields would likely have on, you know, if they encountered a similar situation, I suppose. So there is this in our law, in our tradition, there has been this understanding. And I think both attorney-client privilege and, you could probably hear my daughter in the background, I don't know, she's having fun, but attorney-client privilege and what we have called priest-penitent privilege, these things are there for a reason. And I think there's a good case to be made that they should remain in place. This has centuries long tradition in the Western Christian institutions or countries. And I think fundamentally what it is attempting to do is ensure that a spiritual leader, a Christian pastor, has the freedom to be able to counsel difficult situations and provide spiritual advice to someone without the fear that that person is going to be confessing, as it were, to the state directly. Because otherwise, why not just make the church the arm of the state, right? It's an intention. The intention is to put a separation there. That the purposes for these kinds of things in the context of the church are for a heavenly purpose and not for earthly purposes. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't have a pastor or, I suppose, a priest who, well, now in the case of the Catholic Church, it actually might be different. I think there's a penalty for it if a priest breaks that. It's like the Hippocratic Oath. In a Protestant context, which I'm more familiar with, there is, I think, more of a willingness to report things that are necessary to be reported, but it's at the discretion of the pastor. And generally, the pastor is trying to guide someone spiritually who wants help with these issues towards reporting themselves if it's necessary. So if someone's coming and they want help and they're repentant, normally that's not the kind of person that is committing criminal acts and is presently raping people, let's say. Maybe the rapes have happened, but they've happened, and now it's the aftermath and they're coming to try to get help. And so to shut that off, which is what a policy like this would likely do, would be to probably catapult your society into even more depravity as people feel like they can't even go share with a spiritual leader. So there's probably more that could be said, and probably it could be said by people who know more about this issue than I do. But I do find it rich that it's Rachel Denhollander who's on this crusade against it, when she was the one in favor of waiving attorney-client privilege. And she, her motives have been totally in line with the Me Too agenda and disregarding the due process that we've had established in our country for quite some time. Okay, let's get to the big stuff now, the big stuff that I want to talk about, which involves Gen Z. And I guess what I want to do is, what we're going to do is we're going to go through some stats. I have been one of the outliers, okay, on the right. And I've been skeptical. I've been cautious. I've been optimistic, but I have been cautious on whether or not Gen Z is going to, quote unquote, save us. This seems to be a millennial instinct more than anyone else. Millennials, for some reason, think Gen Z is super right wing and they're going to come up and everything's going to be changed. And it's, some of it might just be propaganda, but like Gen Z is going to save us because young Gen Z males are more right wing. And I've gone through some of the stats on this, and the reason I've been skeptical is because although there's a lot of different stats that insinuate different kinds of things, it does seem there is a right wing shift. Not just in the United States either. It's in Canada. It's in even Japan. But at the same time, you also see on some social issues a softening. So yes, they're more likely to vote for Donald Trump. At the same time, they are more likely to support abortion. Is that right wing? And really the bigger question here is, what kind of right wing is it? That's what I'm, because there's different, the right is somewhat broad, right? You have your libertarians, you have your classic liberals, for lack of a better term. You have your paleocons, you have your Christian reconstructionist theonomy types, and the list just goes on. You got your pagan right, you got your Groiper types. And what exactly is going on with the Gen Z males? Or are they just going into different rooms, as it were, in the building that we call the right? And they are, it's sort of like a distillation into various containers rather than just like they're all in one pot. And I don't know all the answers to that, but I think that a lot of the Zoomer males are more transgressive. And a lot of this is just from my own experience. They feel like they've been kicked to the curb their whole life. They're dealing oftentimes, the stats bear this out certainly, with a lot of dysfunction, and they're tired of being called names because they're white or they're male. And this is all contributing to the situation we have before us. On top of it, they're getting a lot of their information, not because of necessarily a scholarly process or going to legacy institutions, which who can blame them for not wanting to go to legacy institutions, but they are going to chat groups online and it's forming a lot of groupthink. So there's all these different dynamics, which I've talked about before. And obviously there's exceptions to all of this, but I think I'm somewhat confirmed in my skepticism based on this, because this stat is kind of a big deal. This is from March 1st, 2025. I don't know how I missed it. This is from Newsweek, and it's about Gen Z and debt. And it's funny, this whole thing came about because of a conversation I was having with my wife. There's some podcast she listens to about financial, getting out of financial holes, I guess, and some financial advisor. Anyway, Gen Z, apparently, he was saying, is like really bad. And I said, really? So I looked it up. And here's a chart. You can't see it if you're listening, but Gen Z of every generation, that silent boomer, X, millennials, Gen Z. And the reason it's probably only going 97 to 2006 is because at the time, I would assume it's not going to be testing for people who aren't of age, right? So it's these are adult Gen Z people. But they have, per capita, the highest average debt. It's incredible of any group. Now, I think this is per capita. Let's see. Yeah, I believe so. So they have the highest debt, over $90,000 in debt. When you're just starting out life, how do you have about $100,000 in debt? How is that the average? for a Gen Z adult. How? Now, Megan Basham had responded when I posted this, and she's like, well, that's probably like school loans, right? Because we know education's gone up and that kind of thing. No, it's actually not. It is credit card debt. 56% of the debt is credit card debt. Student loans is only 31%. Personal loans, 23%. Medical, 19%. Mortgage, 16%. Auto loans, 10%. So 56% is credit card debt. Now, credit cards, when you have credit card debt, that's like the worst kind of debt. The highest interest rates. I mean, I think that, honestly, the predatory loan industry needs to be put out of business by law. Because we clearly have a generation that doesn't know how to handle finances. Now, I saw people defending all this online saying, well, like, they're, what are they going to do? Their back's against the wall. It's all these structural things that are keeping them, that are preventing them from actually ascending. Now, here's what I want to say to that. Because, I mean, you heard a similar thing right during the woke stuff, right? Look at these minority groups and why there's a disparity. The disparity exists because they have no other option, right? Obviously, there are situations and conditions in history where you think of like coal mines in West Virginia, right? Where it's like, well, you're kind of stuck. You'll never leave Harlan alive because the bank owns you. There's these particular circumstances, and maybe even that's, you know, maybe I'm buying into union propaganda. I don't think so, but there are circumstances. Now, here's the question, because we have a test period coming up that's going to, we will figure out whether this is just a structural setup against Gen Z, which, look, it is harder to buy a house. There are challenges. Granted, there are challenges. Now, the Silent Generation had challenges too, but, you know, let's just, for the sake of argument, say Gen Z's got all these challenges. Right now you have they're not as mass as they should be, but you have deportations happening. Here's the question I have. Who's going to fill the jobs, right? You have all these jobs that are, they're already, some of them are already starting to be vacated, and hopefully there'll be a lot more. And this is the big, people say it's a gamble Trump's taking. He's doing this whole thing, and what's going to happen? You're going to have, the cost of goods is going to go up, and people aren't going to be able to afford to live anymore because you don't have that cheap labor. Well, this is the opportunity for Gen Z, right? Are they going to fill these roles? Are they? I mean, Mike Rowe talks about this all the time, right? There is huge demand already in many of the fields that sometimes people, millennials and Gen Z guys, aren't attracted to for some reason. You know, they're blue collar, roughneck type jobs. And you can go get trained and you can make a good wage at many of these jobs, but there's going to even be more opportunities here coming up. The question is Gen Z going to climb out of the hole? And we can pray. We can pray. Now, I don't think it's a coincidence. This is obviously, correlation doesn't equal causation, but I don't think it's a coincidence that this recent story in Time Magazine that just came out July 17th about Gen Zers says, nearly half of Gen Zers rely on financial help from their parents. Now, this makes it even worse. If this is true, if half of Gen Zers rely on help from their parents, then you already have assistance and dependency in that generation. That's in addition to the credit card slavery. And it is slavery. Proverbs says the borrower is slave to the lender. We have a generation that is enslaved, and we're not even talking about the national debt. There's been choices that they've made to get them to this point. So I understand every circumstance is different, but think with me broadly here. What happens when you have a dependent population? What happens politically under those circumstances? And probably a not as well adjusted population if they're still dependent on their parents. I just saw recently, it's a guy who basically purports to be a leader of young men on the quote unquote far right Christianity or whatever. And it was just revealed that this particular individual, and he's very transgressive, posts all kinds of just engagement farming kinds of things on X that are, frankly, some of them are just very morally disgusting and just, like, you post it for the shock value, right? Well, anyways, this particular individual lives with his parents, doesn't seem to have a job. At least there's no record of it online that you can find. Isn't married, doesn't have children, doesn't have a family, and is around 40 years old. That's a millennial. But I'm just saying, if that's the kind of thing Gen Zers are gravitating towards, if they can respect someone like that, it says something. It's not a good thing. If that's any kind of an indication, if that's any kind of a sign, it's actually, we're losing masculinity. We're losing what it means to be a man. We're losing what virtue is about, and what the normal expectations are. And that's not a good thing. So here's the stat. 6 in 10 Gen Zers like socialism. This is from yesterday, the headline in the New York Post. 6 in 10 Gen Zers like socialism. It's linking it to the New York mayoral race. But March 2025 survey conducted by the Cato Institute in partnership with YouGov, that's so ironic because the Cato Institute's libertarian, found that 6 in 10 New Yorkers between ages 18 and 29 had favorable views of socialism. This is something I've long noticed among my peers. Worse yet, a staggering 34% had a positive view of communism. Now, you could sort of console yourself and say, well, that's got to just be New York. Guys, that's still really, really, really bad. And I would console myself with that. I have to, right? Although I'm sitting in New York. Add to that the fact that 60 to 75% of American college students never take an economics class in college. So they're trying to like figure out why this is. Is it just education? Could we just like through education, is it possible to fix this? Yeah, I mean, education might help, but you have some conditions you're also fighting against here, is my point. And I think as a historian, it just, I tend to ask first, what are the conditions? This is also going to affect how I approach the question of Zionism, which I'm going to be doing a very long podcast. I've been drag kicking and screaming into this, but y'all, there's, I almost only see ignorance on the Christian right about this particular topic when it's brought up historically. And I just think it would be helpful to do a good episode that's got primary sources and is responsible and all those things. So I'm going to do that. That's going to drop later this week, Lord willing. But, and I've been working on that. That's why I haven't had as many podcasts this days, the last few days. But as I'm looking at these things, I am looking at not just, okay, how does theology create? Is everything theological? Is everything ideas in your head? That's an angle. It's not the only thing. Is everything follow the leader and what your leaders say, people? That's certainly true. Power is part of this. That's not the only thing. I am telling you, conditions also make a big difference. The environment, the needs of the day. Oh, why do you think natural law is so big now in Christian circles? It's big because people are realizing the sexual revolution has gone so far, it's erasing the intention God had for his creation when it comes to gender. So what's the need of the hour? What's the natural thing people are going to do? There's an incentive to find something that is going to argue against that position, right? So I look at those things as well. And I'm telling you, the conditions we're in right now, historically speaking, a population of dependents is going to have no qualms with more dependency. It's going to be fine with them. The question is what style or what version of socialism are we getting, I suppose. And I don't say that I don't like any of this. I am against socialism as you can be. I do not want socialism. I'm also not, I'm against in its, you know, ideological form. I'm against capitalism too. I'm against what they used to call commercialism, where the state and the market get involved. And I don't even think what's good for the market is necessarily good for the population. This is why I'm doing the Great Book series, which we are going to get back to, by the way. I know I've had a number of other things in my way, but it's why we're doing the conservative Great Book, so people can be reintroduced to our tradition. We're born into a society with obligations, localism, loving tangible things, being responsible for the things God has put you responsible for to love in your actual environment. And this has economic ramifications downstream. A more free market is not ideologically a free market, but a more a place where you can exercise those responsibilities, and those become the rights you have. They're linked to those responsibilities, is what we've had in the United States for a very long time on a certain level. And that's being eroded. Socialism claims to obviously meet these needs, but everywhere it's tried, it creates problems, it creates disparities, it creates corruption. The respect for law goes down, it creates theft. In the extreme forms, you have these communist dictators that rise to power. Obviously, it is not something we want, and it's out of step with Christianity. This is not a Christian civilization anymore once we get a full-fledged system like that. We already are halfway there, right? We already have so much dependency as a people, but that's accelerating. And I think Gen Z is likely going to accelerate this more. So the question is, what kind of socialism more than, I suppose, anything else? And I was going to show you one more poll. I don't know if I can. Oh, I didn't pull it up, so this was my bad. Let me see if I can do it on a quick search engine, because it was in the news lately. Let's see. It's the support Gen Z has or doesn't have, as the case may be, for Trump. So here's a story. I don't know if this was the one I originally wanted to pull up, but this is the one I'm getting. So it's from Yahoo News. Gen Z support for Trump collapses amidst Epstein fallout. Like, it really collapses. And I don't know if this is all Epstein, but this is the point I want to make on this is U.S. president's approval rating 18 to 29 year olds fell from roughly even around the time of his inauguration in January to minus 40 by July. Well, that's a lot. Okay, now if you're going to attribute that to Epstein, I understand, and I don't have time to get in the Epstein thing right now. I understand, but this also creates the impression that this is a very fickle generation. This is a generation that this is a wild swing. So if that holds, if this is a generation that's very open to innovation, is very open to new ideas, and they will accept them, and they have wild swings in their opinions, and it's okay, and they're dependent, I think we're going to get socialism, guys. I hate to be the bearer of bad news. We got to fight against it, obviously. We got to preserve where we can high trust communities that can resist this kind of thing. But it seems like we're going to get more dependency. It seems like things are ripe for the kind of personalities that can take advantage of the emotions of the masses. I hate to be the one saying this to you. Pray for your country, obviously. I mean, I've been encouraged by some things with Gen Z, but this is sort of confirming some of the gut feelings I've had. Now, the question is, what kind of socialism, right? I've said that like four times now. Is it going to be a national socialism, or is it going to be a international socialism, right? I don't know. I tend to think it's going to be more, I think the woke guys probably still are going to have an advantage moving forward, but I could be wrong. You know, I could very well be wrong. There's history, a lot of converging forces come together, and a lot of things can happen. I don't have time to play this full clip, but I want you to just see a minute of this. This is, a Nick Fuentes fan who's Gen Z. And this is, he was with a journalist, I suppose. I had never heard of this guy. He's, I think, from Al Jazeera, but it's, I hate these things. I'm going to be honest. I hate this format, but this is I think it's called Surrounded, if I'm not mistaken, but it's a format where you're surrounded and someone's on the hot seat and they got to argue with people who oppose their view. In this case, it was a leftist reporter or journalist with supposed far right advocates. And so here's one of the exchanges.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Mandy, lovely to meet you.
So I would say that with Trump being anti-constitution, I don't really care, to be quite frankly.
Okay.
Because in regards to the Constitution is a document that should seek to serve us. Yes. And when it fails to seek to serve us, that can be amended. Laws can be changed. And quite frankly, the fact is, we're defending things in this country that shouldn't be defended. The First Amendment should not defend pornography and making women and children be victimized as a result of that. I think things like blasphemy shouldn't be allowed per the First Amendment. I think that, quite frankly, there are a lot of legal processes that are enabling criminals and bad people to fully enact their will in this country in the name of the Constitution or following the Constitution. So, quite frankly, if Trump is anti-Constitution, good. And I think he should go further.
So,
okay, let me just say something real quick. If that's the Gen Z male, if they all believe that, that's great. It's a huge shift and it's really good, right? Because obviously pornography should not be included as a protected speech under the First Amendment. But here's one of the problems, and you have some ignorance here, and it's like we all have ignorance, right? So I'm not judging the guy. I'm just saying I've seen this sentiment. I've seen it online quite a bit. Very anti-constitution. You got to understand, it's not the Constitution is not it can be amended for one thing, and it's not a suicide pact, but it's an attempt of our founding fathers to bring together principles and the light of experience together to craft something that was suited for the population at that time that could be amended depending on where the population went. It was for a high trust society that had a strong religious and virtuous tendencies, and we don't have that. Now, the problem I see with all this is when you give the impression you just don't give a rip about the Constitution, that's like if you're a British and you don't give a rip about the Magna Carta or the monarchy, let's say, or there's something intrinsic to our identity. We are perhaps the first republic that had a written constitution, at least that's lasted, and it's been the model for other places. There's a lot of good things to glean from the Constitution, even if you think we're post-constitutional, which I've made the case, I think we are in many ways. So here's the thing I would say. Yes, it's the principles behind the Constitution. It's the experience behind the Constitution that we want to defend, right? The Constitution is not a suicide pact, but neither does the Constitution or the Bill of Rights say that pornography or blasphemy is included protected speech. And that's where this guy, he wants to like just throw the Constitution under the bus. How about the reinterpretation of the Constitution, the incorporation doctrine even, that has allowed courts to basically supersede state and local customs and laws that made pornography illegal? That's the problem here. But he blames the Constitution. He gets off on a really bad foot here because, I mean, he's able to make this guy, apparently he's American citizen, but he sounds like he's from Great Britain, but he's able to make this British guy sound like he's somehow more appreciative of America, which is just not obviously great. But I think I'm more concerned about that spirit that just doesn't see the Constitution as valuable. It is valuable, even if you think we're post-constitutional.
This is wonderfully revealing of the modern conservative mindset. So I appreciate you spelling it out. So
great, great. He represents the modern conservative mindset. No, he doesn't.
Openly. Just checking. Do you support the Second Amendment?
I do.
Okay. Surprise. I was shocked to hear that. I'm saying that Donald Trump is defying the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, the 14th Amendment. He's thinking of defying the 12th and 22nd Amendments. Mm. You're saying you don't care about the Constitution, but actually you do because you quite like the Second Amendment. You just don't like the bits that you disagree with. Can I just be clear on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm more than willing to amend it and include
whenever
the
it's in your
Amendment.
Favor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So can Democrats do the same when they're in office?
No, absolutely not. Because
so you don't believe
in
democracy?
Enemy. No, I don't. Absolutely not.
What do you believe in?
Autocracy.
By who?
He's so giddy. That's the thing. He's so giddy. He's excited. He can't even wait to get the words out of his mouth. He's waiting to offend this leftist. Like he's hoping this leftist asks questions because, man, if he asks more questions, I'll get to the point where I can really just make him squirm. And all he's doing is falling into this guy's trap. And I've made this point before, but yes, I'm against the liberal order. I wrote a whole book against it, Against the Waves, right back there. You got to understand, though, that the liberal order, many aspects of it are just freeze-framed kind of conditions that suited a particular society that used to exist that doesn't anymore. What I mean by that is, let me give you an example. Something like, okay, here's one. We have pluralism today in religion, right? But there was a time in which you had tolerated minorities and Christianity was more or less the official religion of every state, some version of Christianity. If it wasn't the official religion, it was the status quo. You can have a more neutral society under those settings where you already have a religious establishment dominating because look, you look around your town, everyone's the same and no one's challenging it, right? Now you have conditions where that's not the case, though. That's not the case at all. You have challenges coming from everywhere, and you have people that even want to erect Satan statues. So what's the problem in that scenario, right? So hopefully you're getting my point. Liberalism is the ideology that keeps us back from doing any of that because it values the neutral society. But it doesn't mean that there wasn't at one time a conservative instinct to say, hey, if it's broke, don't fix it. Our society seems to be doing pretty well. People seem to be pretty virtuous. We don't need a heavy hand backing religion up here. Now, conditions change. That's the thing. That's where paleoconservatives, or just plain old conservatives, if you want, understand conditions change. And so we have to adapt to suit those conditions. But certain fundamental principles don't change. One of those principles is it is the duty of a society, a body politic, to represent and honor the natural conditions or the law that God has established for humans when it comes to things like gender, even things like self-defense. And like, we have an obligation to do those kinds of things. If everyone was Amish, we'd have to change some laws. We'd have to compel. We'd have to have a draft or something, right? It would be a problem, but we don't have that problem because they're not large enough. So the only point I'm trying to make in all this is, in the zeal to kind of go against the liberal order, what you are seeing, I think, in front of you is an example of someone who is just chomping at the bit to be the mirror image of it. He wants to say your terms are acceptable. Everything a liberal says or a leftist says, he wants to say your terms are acceptable. What you paint me as, that's what I am. And, oh, that scares you? That's what I'm trying to do, is to scare you. And it is a massive liability right now for the right if you have too many guys like this. But I think it's out of ignorance. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt. I think he genuinely thinks he's doing something good here, but it's grandstanding. It's not thinking about the consequences of what he's saying. And it, frankly, some of it is coming from a place of ignorance. And that's why he's being toyed with by
this journalist. With Trump being anti-constitution, I don't really care, to be quite frankly.
Okay.
Because
if... I don't know what happened there. Okay, let me keep playing here.
Honestly, quite frankly, anyone who is in line with Catholic teaching.
Donald Trump is not Catholic.
Of course, he's not. I completely agree.
So,
and that's,
you support
part of the problem.
Trump? You don't support Trump?
No, I don't. I didn't even vote for him. I wrote in like John Pork or someone. I can't even remember.
Why did you vote if you don't believe in democracy and you want autocracy?
Well, because quite frankly, I voted. I kind of voted just to.
I came with this argument, but I'm bored of my own argument. I'm much more interested in this. So
yeah, absolutely.
How do we get to an autocracy?
I think, quite frankly, that if we are able to enact local leaders...
Who is the we, by the way?
I think, quite frankly, these far-right conservatives sitting right around
white
me.
People?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So,
well,
some
actually,
of you guys,
I have quite...
Some of the people
I
in this room quite, don't make the cut,
no,
from what I can see
actually,
visually.
Actually, okay. Hold on for a moment. I do think that there are people who happen to not be white who do actually have history in this country and have roots in this country. For instance, from the Mexican-American War, we subsumed a lot of territory of people who have far stakes in this country who happen to be Hispanic or what have you.
Okay.
I'm for defending the traditional demographics of this country, which...
He's the point he's making isn't bad as far as, like, the third worldism as of late, last few decades is insane. And I want to go defend the traditional makeup and that kind of thing. But you can tell, like, he shouldn't even be in this frame with this guy. Like, he got here because he wanted to be edgy, and he starts bringing in some of his reasonable answers. And it's like, he's stuck in a trap. He's stuck in a trap.
Majority white. And
so how,
should stay that
how
way.
How does the United States... I mean, we've gone so off topic, but how does the United States look like under you? Sorry, what's your name?
My name's Connor. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Took a little bit of a doubt there.
Oh, well, I use a pseudonym online.
Fair enough.
But fair enough.
He uses a pseudonym. Why is he, you know, it's like, of course you're going to get doxxed. If you didn't think about that before going, right, this is a careless move, right? You can't keep the pseudonym and go on a show that's got millions of viewers like that.
How would Connor's America look? What would it look like?
Well, quite frankly, I think we would deport people who shouldn't be here.
I didn't ask about deporting. What does the government look like?
What does the government look like?
Yeah.
I would say, quite frankly, it's under a sort of benevolent leader such as
Franco. Where
does
he come from?
It could be a kind of aristocratic class. Could be someone
who picks the autocrat?
Frankly, the people. I mean, we could hold a vote on it.
Isn't that democracy?
Well, sure. You can have a vote to get to that state.
And then no more votes afterwards.
Absolutely.
Wow.
100%.
Wow. And if that autocrat kills you and your family, you're fine with that?
well, I'm not going to be a part of the group that he kills, because that's the whole thing.
How
well,
do you know?
Carl Schmitt
Autocrats
makes,
tend to
Carl
kill Ma- everyone,
Carl
even their
Schmitt
own supporters.
Makes this point very well in his work. It's the friend-enemy distinction, right? You
Carl
liberals...
Schmitt, the-
Some people probably don't... aren't... What do I even say? I don't know. Some people probably shouldn't be trusted with some kind of boiled down version of friend enemy distinction or no enemies on the right, or I don't know, a number of concepts that honestly, if you're responsible, you should be able to use and understand. But this gets, I don't have the time right now, but if you keep watching, it gets him into this whole arena where he's defending Nazis, kind of like he's very uncertain about whether he kind of in a cavalier way dismisses the critiques against, well, how do I put this? He's uncertain about what Hitler did, it seems like. And he's trying to get to the next thing. So he just kind of says, yeah, if he did anything bad, if he did, I'll condemn that. But because I'm a Catholic, but you know, I'm fine being a fascist. And he creates this big mess, essentially. And I'm not bringing this up to condemn the guy. I don't want to hit him when he's down. I mean, I look at him like, what if he was my little brother? And how would I treat that kind of a person? Like, I would be like, don't get in that situation without some help. You know what your mission is, what you're trying to go there to do. But I would also ask him, like, who are you listening to? I mean, this is, the optics of this are so off. The Roman Catholic Church is going to be the main organizing principle of this new place. It's going to be an autocracy. It's going to be fascistic and unapologetic about all those things. No need to really define anything. Nazis might be okay. It's just saying edgy things to kind of say edgy things. And so, you know, does this itself, is this compatible with the trend? And if there is a trend towards socialism on the Gen Z right, and I would submit to you, I think it might be. I think this may be compatible. I don't think this, hearing a kid like this, I would be surprised if this is the kind of guy who's going to really want to preserve some of the very iconic American things like federalism and localism and constitutional restraints and more or less a limited free market, but one that takes into account the responsibilities and rights that one has under a very Protestant, by the way, Christian system. I mean, Protestants bring sort of this individualism, this work ethic that Max Weber talks about quite a bit, that it's different than Roman Catholic countries. I don't know how to put it. Like there is more of an authoritarian stream in Roman Catholics. And it doesn't mean all Roman Catholics. I mean, Samuel Huntington makes this point in his 2003 book, Who Are We?, that a lot of Roman Catholics who have been here for a long time have assimilated to a Protestant societal norm. But that's not what I'm hearing from this guy. And even if he's right, which I don't think he is, but the optics are so bad and it sounds so un-American, he's literally able to make a foreigner, someone who wasn't born in the United States, who even has a different accent, look like that guy's more supportive of American institutions and American documents and that kind of thing. I mean, remember, America was formed away from a monarchy, in a sense, even though that was a constitutional monarchy. America was a constitutional republic. And it doesn't mean conditions don't change and things can't change, but you're talking about drastic innovative changes that would take revolutionary movements. You're talking about something that ideology would accomplish. This isn't something that's rooted in traditional America, really. That's what I'm seeing. Okay. That's my opinion. So my takeaway, since I got to leave and I've probably already gone over time here. Hey, look, these guys that go this direction that I see online all the time. Now you saw someone in person. I don't think that it's always, sometimes it might be prudent to correct, but I'm not here to like just condemn someone who seems ignorant or, you know, that they're trying to fight what they see in front of them. That's an actual threat. I do think there's some ideas that probably need to be condemned in this whole Groiper thing. But I think that it's hard to make this separation, but there are guys who genuinely want to be in the battle. They want to be in the real battle, not the fake battle. And they feel for so long that they've been in a fake battle. The conservatives, quote unquote, that they've been following in national politics don't want to do anything. And it reminds me a little bit of like the libertarian phase that so many millennials went through. I kind of dabbled with it a little bit. It was very ideological. It was very judgmental. It was very idealistic. It sounded utopian. It was revolutionary. We even called some of it the Ron Paul Revolution, right? And it was, and it condemned everyone else who didn't agree. It was, but it was internally, it was very factious. And I see that dynamic also playing out. There's purity spirals in this. So my hope is that there are wiser people who can facilitate a kind of a direction from this kind of thing to a more mature outlook. If we can do that, if we can see guys who are in this kind of world who are born in America, raised in America, but maybe not familiar with their American heritage as much as they should be, and the positive things that actually have been, that are their birthright, maybe we can reintroduce that. Maybe we can bring these people along and we can help in some way mature them if they're willing, right? That's been my posture and continues to be my posture. But I'm not going to give you a rosy picture that Gen Z males are just going to save us. I don't think it's going to happen unless God does something. So, okay. I'm really enjoying the I Can't Even John. Yeah, the I Can't Even John. He comes out every now and then where I'm just like, man, I can't even. So was that it? Yeah, I think that was it. There was one clip I wanted to play for you at the end and I got to get to it. AJ Slope says, has he seen the last three popes? I wouldn't trust the Roman Catholic Church. I know, right? It's like, what in the world? Roman Catholics, by the way, statistically speaking, also have higher levels of support for things like homosexuality and abortion over evangelicals. So evangelicals are the bulwark, guys. Stephen Wolf's tweet from whatever it was 2 years ago, whatever you think of Stephen Wolf, the whole classification of white evangelicals as the bulwark, it's kind of true. Obviously, the British Muslim would be in favor of systems and support people like him and punish those unlike him, the kid in the video. Sure. Yeah, I mean, the friend enemy thing. The idea that there's friends and enemies and you punish those who are your enemies politically. I mean, that's called history. That's called the lamp of experience. That certainly does happen. The Constitution isn't a suicide pact. Yep. Very true. All right. Sorry, guys. I wish I could get to more of your comments, but I got to get to Bible study. I'm going to play this clip in closing. This is a beautiful thing. And I just think it touched me. I almost cried. Mike Riccardi talking about the last words that John MacArthur gave before he left this earth. And I'm just going to leave it there. I'm not going to say anything after I play this clip, but I think this would encourage you. This is how we want to live our lives so that when we can get to the end, when every word is taken into account and before the judgment seat of Christ, we hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant, because every idle word will be taken account of. And here's what John MacArthur said.
I hope it's okay to share. You know, it was reported to me by some of those who were with John in the hours that he was ready to go to heaven. And one of the verses that were on his mind as some of his last words was 1 Corinthians 15:55. Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, death, where is your sting? And he was speaking about how the resurrection of Christ is the conquest of all of that. And it was reported to me that in between gasps for air, he said, I feel no sting. I feel no fear.